I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food today. How are you? I'm good. Happy St. Patty's Day. I'm sipping on a little green tea. That's good. And we celebrated earlier with a St. Patty's Day plate. It looked like the flag with a little sautéed kale and collards on the left, millet in the middle, and sweet potatoes on the right. Green, white, and orange for the Irish flag. Green for the Catholics, white for peace and hope, and orange for Protestants. I think that's how it works. Anyway, it was delicious. So let's move to my first guest. Wayne Weissman is a permaculture teacher, designer, consultant, and author. He lives in Carbondale, Illinois. He was certified to teach permaculture by Bill Mollison, the founder of permaculture, and is recognized by the Worldwide Permaculture Network as an instructor of the Permaculture Design Certificate course. So, welcome to It's All About Food, Wayne.
Hi, good afternoon.
How are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Okay, where is Carbondale?
Carbondale is in southern Illinois, about 20 minutes from the confluence of the Ohio and Mississippi rivers.
I don't know about Carbondale. Is it related at all to carbon?
It is. This was a huge coal mining area, and there still is some semblance of coal mining here. And now, of course, fracking is trying to make its way in here. So carbon is definitely appropriate.
Wow. And you're working on permaculture in Carbondale.
In Carbondale and all around the world, mostly in this country right now.
Great. Well, that's interesting. We may get back to Carbondale in a moment. Okay. Permaculture. I know a lot of people have heard about it, but can you just give a brief explanation of what it is?
Okay. It's been around since the 1970s and was created by Bill Mollison in Australia and his student David Holmgren. And the word was originally a contraction of permanent and agriculture. And then as the years have passed, Mollison realized that it was more about permanent culture. It's a comprehensive planning and design system that takes in agriculture, which would include plants and animals, and gardening, the built environment, how we use energy systems on a property, et cetera. So it's a comprehensive lifestyle planning science, I guess you would call it.
Okay. Now, our current system of agriculture, which is more like agribusiness for the most part, I think many of us who are concerned about the food system know that it's not a good system and it's got a lot of problems, and many people are doing what they can to work within the system or work outside of the system but make it better. Do you think it's possible to use permaculture for all of our agriculture?
Yeah, I do. As a matter of fact, permaculture is predicated originally on small intensive systems, meaning that it's a cumulative effect. For instance, in my property here in southern Illinois, I'm on a fifth of an acre, and we produce probably 50 to 60% of our food on this small property, which includes chickens and fruit and nuts and vegetables. And if you were to extrapolate out of this property and move it across the entire neighborhood on each property, we would have more food that we can possibly eat. In terms of large-scale systems, permaculture is more about agroforestry and practices such as silvopasture, which are animals under trees, et cetera, et cetera. So we are looking at more perennial agricultural systems with annuals mixed in rather than just a straight annual production. And of course, in modern agriculture, it's more of a monoculture where single species are planted on a large scale.
You have a fifth of an acre. And what kind of plants are you growing?
Well, in this fifth of an acre, we have 250 species of plants. So it's very diverse. We're growing a wide variety of fruit in the front yard, which is a forest environment that's covered by a thick mulch. As a matter of fact, all the neighbors now rake their leaves into my yard in the winter. So there's, yeah, there is no lawn. And then the backyard, I have a mix of perennials and annuals. With the annual crops, I go out in the spring and basically broadcast the seeds out on the beds. And whatever comes up, I will continually harvest the seed through the year. So I'm raising more of a hardy crop rather than something has to be nursed along. So we're talking about all the different levels. In other words, we work with vertical layers as well as horizontal layers in permaculture. So every niche that we can fill, that's what we're after. So, for instance, in my yard, we have different layers in the root system, from tap roots to mid-level to surface feeding roots and way of plants, and then an herbaceous layer, a ground cover, small fruiting bushes, and then as we climb up the ladder, everything all the way up to climax species. What's unique about a place like Carbondale is there already is a mature canopy of oaks and maples, et cetera. And then I always look at it as we are inserting other species in the understory into that overstory. And so that's pretty much how it works. As far as varieties go, peaches, plums, I could go on and on. I'd say we have about maybe 25 species of nuts and fruits.
Wow.
Or even more than that. And then, like I say, lots of herbaceous species. And then I also let a lot of so-called wild plants come in and use those for food and medicine and utility.
Now, the weather is not so great in Illinois. So what's your growing season?
Well, this is we're about 10 to 15 degrees warmer on average than Chicago. We're actually below the Mason-Dixon line. So if we get a large snow in the winter, which is erratic, it doesn't happen every year, it'll melt within a week. And we're actually situated right in between two jet streams, and we don't get very extreme cold in the winter. There are a couple of weeks that we might get down to 5 or 10, but it usually will warm back up to about 40 or 50. So our growing season, the last frost date is April 10th to 15th, and the first frost date comes usually mid-October to late October. So we are growing here. I've already planted peas and spinach a while back, and when I get back from my latest excursion, which starts tomorrow, I'll be teaching and consulting. At the beginning of April, I'll be planting a whole bunch of cold crops and more cold weather crops. And some of my trees are already budding, and some of them are beginning to leaf out. So we are zone 7A, 7B, which has gone up a zone since I first moved here 20 years ago. And I'm pushing it with plants that are in zone 8A.
What does that mean, the zones?
These are the USDA agricultural zones, and it goes by climate. The first thing that we pay attention to in permaculture systems and our design work is climate. And so that means that, for instance, if you're up in Wisconsin, where I'm going to this weekend, we're up around zone 5. So the colder the weather through the year, the lower the zone.
All right. Now, who's wanting to study about permaculture? Are these individuals? Are these businesses? Are these big farmers?
All of the above. I just did a course at my annual course at George Mason University in Virginia. I just got back on Sunday, and we had 40 people in the course. It's very hard to pinpoint and target who the audience will be. But I can tell you that we had everything from doctors to architects to engineers to students at the university to you name it, they show up. And I think it's because these skills are appropriate no matter what race, religion, it really makes no difference. They are lifestyle skills that are appropriate for anybody. And it's very, like I said, it's very difficult to find, to find a target audience. It's very broad.
Okay, now you're obviously very familiar with Carbondale, Illinois, but I imagine permaculture is going to be different in different climates, in different zones. How does that affect what you're going to teach and what people are ultimately going to grow?
Right. Well, there are a specific set of principles and methodologies that we use. And some templates for design work and for implementation. Those methodologies and principles work across the board. It makes no difference the scale. It could be on the 30th story floor apartment building in the middle of New York City, or it could be on 1,000 acres. So based on the fact that these methodologies work everywhere, the only difference would be in climate and then what we can grow in that climate, what animals we can insert into the landscape. So as far as a plant list might go, or what plants we might be growing, that is really the only difference. And as I said, the methodologies and permacultures hold, methodologies and principles hold true no matter where we are.
Okay, I live in an apartment building in New York City. I'm on the third floor. I have a small terrace. What can I grow?
Okay.
Permaculture style.
You know, I'm originally from New York. Here's what I did all winter at my place. We had all of our crops that probably finally finished at the beginning of December. We bring all those indoors. We dehydrate food, which we use all winter long. We ferment. So we're making all kinds of kimchis and krauts and pickles and, anyway, fermentations. We are growing microgreens with diffused light, which are kale, collards, etc., and they grow to about maybe 4-inch to 5-inch leaves tops. So we have fresh salads all winter, and it's very live food, because when you are sprouting seeds and you're using a small vegetable, it's more power-packed than any other type of vegetable. We're also growing wheatgrass in the windows, and we juice wheatgrass. All the soil that we use for those goes into our worm bins in the basement. We're also sprouting all winter, and that includes wild seeds and things like alfalfa and clover. So we're having fresh sprouts with all of our meals. And grew mushrooms this winter. We just harvested our shiitakes and dried them in the dehydrator. So we add those to all kinds of dishes and to green smoothies. And now, because the seasons are so close together here in Carbondale, we're able to start our cultivation very soon. If you have a terrace and you've got good sunlight, especially if you're a south-facing terrace, then you can grow all kinds of herbs and vegetables out there, and fruits can also be grown indoors. We can also grow indoors under lights. We can also create aquaponic systems indoors, which are a combination of fish and plants, where the fish effluent goes to fertilizing the plants and works in a cyclical way. There's hundreds of different techniques that we can use indoors as well as outdoors. And plus the fact that if you're in the city, there is also opportunities in community gardens and also with rooftop gardening.
And how much space do you use inside your home for growing food?
Not really all that much, but I have to say it looks like a jungle. There is kombucha brewing in all the cabinets. There's fermented things all over the countertops. All the windows are taken up by plants, and it's actually, it creates a wonderful environment indoors and a very healthy environment to see all this fresh green growing through the darker months of winter.
Mm-hmm. Boy, I love that.
Yeah.
Okay, you wrote a book, came out last year. Unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to read it, but it's called Integrated Forest Gardening?
Yes.
What is three words that don't exactly go together in my mind?
Okay, well, forest gardening is depending on where we are, we mimic the local bioregion and local ecosystem, and then we insert we're not trying to recreate an ecosystem, but we're inserting higher yielding species into, if we're in an area that has a forest environment, we're inserting higher yielding species into a forest ecosystem, and that becomes a harvest forest. So by integrated, we mean that it is a diverse, what we call a polyculture, and poly meaning many, a diverse polyculture of plants, and all those plants have specific, for instance, we use nitrogen fixers and flowering plants that flower throughout the entire year, different plants that can attract beneficial insects and pollinators. We use every niche, as I mentioned before, vertically as well as horizontally, and that's known as stacking functions. So we're looking for functions that can support other, that can support plants within this conglomerate of plants. And for instance, like a nitrogen fixer will help to feed nitrogen to plants that don't necessarily fix a lot of nitrogen. So anyway, all of these functions work together in relationship, and these plants help support one another, and that is a forest garden. And these combinations of plants, we also call those plant guilds, and several combinations of plant guilds would be a forest garden. So as a quick example of this, we might have an overstory tree, which could even be a dwarf fruit tree that grows up to about 12 feet tall, and then all of the species that sit under that tree all the way down to the lower levels in the soil. That is a forest garden. It is usually predominantly perennial, but we've also been sticking annuals into forest gardens with a lot of success.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you have a vision for the future? Where would you like to see it go? Do you see everyone make growing their own food or some of it?
Yeah, I would love to see that. And I think that, not only do I think that, but I know that it's doable on a small piece of property. So for instance, on my fifth of an acre, I work maybe 7 to 10 full days a year because it's completely mulched. I spend most of my time harvesting. It's very easy work. And my vision would be what we would call small and slow solutions. That would mean that a neighborhood would take it on themselves to create these small edible and medicinal and utility plant landscapes. And the combination thereof would produce a very high yield. Whatever excess we had would be turned back into... In permaculture, we have three ethics, care of earth and care of people, and then what we might call fair share or redistribution of surplus back into the first two ethics. And so we would turn our excess yield back into those first two ethics by distributing food. Years ago when I was driving down to Texas to teach a course north of Dallas, I was passing through Arkansas, and there was a combine harvesting cotton out in the fields, and I had this, and there was nobody driving the combine. It was run by a GPS unit, and I had this image of what it was like with Arkansas cotton, which happens to deplete the soil completely, and I was just thinking back through the old cotton plantations and slavery and all that, and I wrote a note to my friend, and I said, well, you know, what's the use of doing all this? It just seems so overwhelming. He wrote back to me that we have to hold out hope for people. And I've never forgotten that. And no matter who I teach or who I work with or who I consult with, this is what I always have in my mind, front and center. And that the feeling is that the more we can get the word out and the more we can continue to do this work and to implement, that my hope for the future is that that we can create some semblance of a Garden of Eden, and where people have access to local meaning right at the back door, and very healthy foods.
That sounds good to me.
Yeah.
You have a terrific blog, and not only are you interested in plants, but you're a bit of a poet.
I guess so. Yeah, I've been writing poetry for many years and was a songwriter for many years and played music, and all the inspiration came out of being out in the woods since I was a kid. I know I grew up right outside New York City in New Jersey. And when I was a kid, it was pretty much rural west of New Jersey. And I spent hours and hours out in the woods learning about plants and animals. And that grew into my work in agriculture and as a builder, et cetera, et cetera. I've had many different lifetimes, I think, in this lifetime. But the inspiration for all of my writing definitely comes from the natural world, without a doubt.
Can you talk about your teacher, Bill Mollison, who created permaculture? You said that he has repeatedly stated the problem is the solution. Can you talk a little bit about the problem being the solution?
Right. Bill was grew up in an agricultural family in Tasmania. which is off the coast of Australia. We always, I don't know who remembers the Tasmanian devil. But
of course.
Then he became, I guess, a field biologist, we might call it, and he traveled all over the world and studied indigenous cultures in the way that they were supporting extended families on a quarter acre or less. And what he saw was wherever there was an underlying or overlying constraint on the people, that we need to basically lift the veil of the constraint and look inside it and search for opportunity within the constraint. So if we have a constraint based on climate, we need to be able to look inside of that. And what Bill always says is that the only limitations in our design work are the limitations in the imagination of the designer. And I agree fully with that. And this is what I am attempting to get my students to break open their thinking, which in some ways has been beaten out of us as students in this world, and to get them to start to break open their thinking and through the basic methodologies, some basic physics, to start to create off the cuff and just let it ride. And that's what we're looking for. We're looking for solutions that we can uncover inside the problems and to break that problem open and see what is available in our environment, in our landscape. So if it's climate and we have frost dates on either side of the growing season, we might ask ourselves, how many different ways can we extend the growing season, or how many different ways can we find the possibility of having our own fresh food 365 days a year?
Well, that's all very hopeful to me. I like that point of view. And yeah, we need to encourage our students and everyone to, I hate to use the cliche, but get outside of the box and be creative. All the answers are there.
Exactly.
Wow. All right. Now, I think people are probably thinking, I know I'm thinking, this all sounds really lovely. I would love to be able to do all of this, but it sounds kind of complicated to get started. How do individuals get started?
Okay, a few things. One thing would be to take a course, and we have pretty much a standard 72-hour permaculture course. It's called the Permaculture Design Certificate course, or to begin by starting to research and to go online to look at books, to go to lectures and smaller workshops to get a small taste to begin. But my whole thing is, if you've never done any of this before, somehow get a hold of 6 tomato plants or 8 tomato plants and plant them in different spots in your backyard and observe for 1 year and see what you've got. In the meantime, as you've implemented this small system, or even a little bit more than tomatoes, whatever it might be, you're observing, but you're also researching as you move through the year and finding out what might be the next steps. You can also, folks can also contact people like me or other practitioners that have had many. I've been putting these systems on the ground for over 40 years. And I've had a lot of hands-on experience on just about every area of permaculture. I would say that 80-85% of what I teach, I've actually done. And I think that's important to find a seasoned practitioner. You know, there's many ways to go about it. And to find ways that we don't necessarily have to stop doing what we're already doing, but to be able to find a fit to be able to do this. And as I mentioned before, with the small system that I'm talking about at my place, it's very doable. And I think it just takes visiting sites, talking with people, searching around, and we have to take that first step. We've got to get across that threshold. And there is no failure in this system. As a matter of fact, all we're really looking at, because it is whole system design and implementation, we're looking for feedback rather than mistakes. Anything that might look like a mistake is really there to inform us.
Oh, I like that. It's feedback. It's not a mistake. That's exactly. Beautiful. Yes. We could apply that to everything in life, couldn't we?
Definitely, yes.
Okay, so I could really see more individuals on small pieces of property getting this going and having it work nicely for them, either to supplement the food that they get or be the primary source of food. But it's taken 50 to 100 years for us to totally transform the agricultural land of the United States. And we've gone from little to medium to huge. And most of the food is grown by giant agribusiness, monocropped. We're growing all the wrong things in the wrong places in the wrong way. You see a way to transform that?
Yeah. So what I do when I work with farmers and I work with folks that have large-scale properties, I would suggest to them that they start small and they build out from there. We may create a master plan over 10 years, 15 years, but we're working toward that master plan. So, of course, in the natural world, you're never going to have a final result. We can't control the natural world, but we can certainly set up the ground and to continually build fertility into a property. So to start small, so if there's a large-scale farmer that's got a lot of acreage, I always suggest to them that they run some trials on a quarter acre or less to try to get into these systems and to begin to reincorporate perennial systems and larger-scale rotational grazing systems into their property. And the key to all this is to build fertility. Without good soil and fresh water, then basically we're doomed. And I always think of it as peak soil and peak water, and that is my central focus. Peak oil, we can't drink oil and we can't bathe in it, but certainly fertile soil and fresh water are most important. On large-scale properties where people aren't necessarily doing a lot of agricultural work initially, again, the same suggestions: start in and around their home, which is where most of their living is happening. We have in permaculture a template called the zone system, and it's six zones. Zone zero is usually the home, or let's say a business where there's more activity or frequency of activity happening. And as you move out to zone five, you're actually visiting that part of the property less and less. And when you get out to zone five, it's more of a wild area. It may not mean that we necessarily intrude on that area except to harvest or to hunt or whatever that might be. So I always am speaking to people about and designing into systems where we intensively work around zone zero, zone one, zone two. And as we expand our system, we expand out into these zones that we don't visit as much. But that also doesn't mean that we might not plan agroforestry out in zone four, combinations of larger grazing areas, et cetera, and all of that can go in at once, but we want to make sure that this is doable and at human scale for people, and we also want to make sure that it's affordable. So that's why I said trials in smaller areas or beginning small and moving forward and expanding. That's really the key to all of this, so that it doesn't, you know, I've worked as a farmer for many years and as a builder, and I know that when we try to do too many things at once, then the overwhelm would start, and we always had to scale back and make sure that our initial systems were in gear and working properly.
Okay, one last question. You said your neighbors like to rake the leaves over onto your property because you use it for mulch. Do your neighbors like what you're doing? Do some of them learn from you? Do they see what you're doing? Is it strange to them? What's the reaction?
No, they don't think it's strange at all. They love it, and they're sharing in all of the yield here and the chicken eggs and all that. The neighbors next to mine, the next one and the next one, have all put in raised beds to grow vegetables. I planted fruit trees around the neighborhood for folks. They're picking up on it. And here's what I can say about it. We build it, and they definitely will come. And it's certainly a lot more essential to do this than to get out on a pulpit and proselytize. I think it's there's certainly a lot of room for lecturing and presenting all of this material, but when we actually build these systems and put them on the ground, it gives people a visual so that they can actually see it. And then I've had, from the university here, I've had some interns that have helped me work on the property. My next step here is to go to the city council with a report on miniature goats so that we can now have fresh dairy and raw milk and to make cheese and yogurt and kefir and things like that. And I'm hoping that it took us 2 years to get chickens here. The other thing is by being able to break through the codes here and to get chickens, there's now 20 families in Carbondale that raise chickens. And I'm hoping that we can take some more steps. So it leaks out all over these neighborhoods and people are seeing it. People walk by when I'm working out in the yard and they want to know what's going on. Then I offer them a fresh peach. And you know what it's like to bite into a fresh peach that comes right off the tree.
I haven't had a really good fresh peach in about 40 years.
Well, you need to have one.
I need to have one. Well, it all sounds really wonderful. I have to say I'm a vegan, so the chicken and the goat thing is not something that's exciting me, but it's got to be a lot better than what we're doing in factory farms today, which is just horrifying. I really encourage everyone to go, whatever you can do, learn about this and grow some food. We've got to take control of our food system because it's really out of hand. But so you've offered a lot of information, a lot of hope. Thank you very much for joining me on It's All About Food, Wayne.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, take care.
Okay.
Okay. Whew. Let's take a little break, and then we're going to take some virtual echo adventure travel trips, shall we? I'll be right back. Hi, everybody. We're back. How are you doing today? It's St. Patty's Day. Are you wearing some green or orange or drinking some beer? What are you doing? Amazing. Celebrating, I hope. I want to bring on my next guest, Donna Zeigfinger. Seasoned world traveler she is. She founded Green Earth Travel in 1997 with one mission in mind, to provide a wide range of travel options for people who crave adventure and care about the planet. How are you doing, Donna?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. So what are you wearing? You got any green on?
You know what? I just checked because I was like, oh, my God, did I wear green today? Yes, I have. It's an olive green T-shirt, so I'm good.
Okay, you're good. I like to wear both green and orange.
Right.
Kind of a balance between, hope and peace and Catholics and Protestants and whatever.
There you go.
Balance.
Right.
Yeah. Look, I'm always looking for an opportunity to celebrate food in any way I can. So it's green and orange food today.
And travel.
And travel.
Love to celebrate travel.
There we go. Now, what I learned from you when I met you a few weeks ago is that you've been doing this vegan thing for a very long time.
Yes, longer than most people listening have been around.
Right. And so of all things to decide to do, you decided to do Green Earth Travel, and you've been doing it almost 20 years, 18 years.
Yeah, it's actually been longer than that. When I got into the travel, I've been a vegan since 1983.
Wow.
Yeah, something. Anyway, and as soon as all my friends found out I was a travel agent, they were like, oh, you got to support her. She's vegan. She'll help us. Blah, blah, blah. You know, so that's where it started. It's been 30 years, 30-something years. Anyway, yes.
Now, I imagine there are far more places to travel easily as a vegan without having to pull out all your explanations and apologize.
Well, I never apologize, but yeah. what I make them do is make them eventually put it, I don't make them, but they get annoyed with me enough where they put it in their menu and it actually sells very well. I've had that happen a few times. But, you know, I started doing this, as I said, in the 80s, and I would get other travel agents who weren't necessarily vegetarian. They would see a vegetarian restaurant and they would pick up their business card and give it to me, and we would write you know, from overseas to each other. And that's kind of how it started. And it's so much easier now. It's
with
just
the
so
internet.
Much easier.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the internet and just in general, you know, all of these places are putting vegan options because people want it. There's a demand for it. So, it's definitely a lot easier than it was back then.
So what do you do at Green Earth Travel? Do you come up with packages and programs for people?
Yeah, I mean, we do both. We have both groups that we have going, and we can customize trips for people. I can book their airfare ticket, their airline tickets. I can find them hotels that'll work for them, and I will work with the chefs or, you know, whoever, you know, the food and beverage department, whoever it takes to make sure that they can eat as a vegan. So, and so we book the air, the hotel, the cruise ships, whatever, the train. I just went on the train recently and had a vegan burger. I was blown away.
Which train? Amtrak?
Amtrak.
Wow. Well, that's a long time coming because my sister, who's also vegan, has asked them many, many times, and she got horrible responses. So that's very exciting to hear.
It's very exciting.
It only takes a lot of complaining, whining vegans to get action.
And we can be whiny.
Does that have chicken broth in it? Does that have fish sauce?
Yes.
Yes, don't. You know, I know a lot of people are intimidated to request food outside of their home or in a restaurant, and it gets even more intimidating when you're in a foreign country and the language is different. So I imagine this can be help make the trip more relaxing.
Oh, yeah, it definitely can. There's actually an app where you can get – well, there's a couple of apps. You can get the Happy Cow app, you know, if you want to find restaurant listings. But if you – you know, there's a translator now that you can get, a free translator. And I used it when I was in the Dominican Republic this past fall. And, you know, all you do is say what you eat or don't eat, and it translates it for you. It'll actually say it, so you don't have to show it. It'll actually say it for you.
You know, I have this thing. I've had it for so long, the vegan passport.
Right.
It cost me like $5, and I've taken it everywhere. And my favorite time was back around 1999. I was doing a lot of travel to Korea back in my engineering days, and I was in this. Usually there was somebody who was taking me around. They were always really very protective of me when I was traveling there, my colleagues. But at one point I was alone, and I remember being in a restaurant, and I gave this server the book, and she read the Korean page so intently, so respectfully. I was blown away, and she just nodded and brought me some beautiful food.
Wow. That's awesome.
True story.
Yeah. And especially in those areas because, you know, Korea, Japan, China are not always the easiest. You would think they would be, but they're not always the easiest to get vegetarian food.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to have chicken broth or fish broth in everything, including their rice.
Right.
So you have to be very,
very vigilant and aware.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, so where can we go with Green Earth Travel? Where have you been? Where are you going?
Well, I'm actually going to Italy this summer. I'm taking a group of people, and it's with a lot of, I like calling them celebrities. They won't call themselves celebrities, but I think they're vegan celebrities in their own right. And, you know, we've got one in June with Colleen Patrick Goudreau,
mm-hmm.
and then we've got, and that's the end of June, and then we've got like a month long, you can take, pick your week with different vegan celebrities. We've got, the first week is with the Hen House Girls, and Jason Weirich. Jason Weirich is, he's
good. We love Jason.
Yeah.
I had him on the show. We talked about his vegan tacos book. And I talked to a lot of chefs on this show, a lot of vegan chefs and cookbook authors. And he blew me away with his knowledge and his skill. He's like at the top of the list for me.
Yeah, he's great. And the three of them together are going to be a lot of fun. You know, those hen house girls are fun. Mm-hmm. And then the week two, we've got Dr. Ruby Lathan, who, you know, she's a dietitian and a speaker, and, you know, she does a lot of great work. And we teamed her up with Carolyn Scott Hamilton of the Healthy Voyager.
All right.
Mm-hmm. And then week three is Miyoko Shinner and Matt Frazier. Miyoko's got those unbelievable cheeses that I can't have, vegan cheeses that I can't eat another kind of vegan cheese ever again. I have to only have hers, and I can't wait till they come to Whole Foods, because I have to go cold turkey. I just bought some last week, and I ate the whole round by myself.
I just want to make a comment about vegan cheese here, and I love Miyoko, and I'm so glad she's doing what she's doing. But just like dairy cheeses, there are thousands of varieties of dairy cheeses, and we will soon have as many, if not more, because the vegan people are so creative and so passionate about food, and the cheeses are just going to get better.
Right. Yeah, I know. But I love hers right now. And, you know, I want her to come live in my house and make it. But anyway, and then there's Matt Frazier, who I've known for a few years, and no meat athlete. He's going to take people on hikes and do some fun stuff. And then the last week we have is Fran Costigan. And we also, with Fran Costigan, have Binay, general manager of Candlelight 79.
Yes.
And she just joined us with Fran. So the two of them, I mean, it's going to be food and chocolate, and you can't get anything better than that. So, you know, I mean, it's basically going to be in southern Italy. It's a week long that you can take. And, you know, so you can go as a couple, come as, you know, as a single, and you can bring, you know, family, as long as the children are over 10 years old, or, you know, it's good. And so that's where I'm going this summer. But I really encourage everyone to join us. But I did go to the Dominican Republic last year, and I was so pleasantly surprised with this place. It's not in the Punta Cana area, which is very touristy, which can be nice, but it is very touristy. It's in a town called Cabarete, and it was a resort called Natura Cabanas. And I've been sending people there for the past 10 years, and nothing but rave reviews about it, with the exception of, like, one or two minor things. And the chef that just started there, I don't know, like 3 months before, he's been vegan for 2 years, and wow. He is so excited to do all these, you know, vegan menus, and, you know, they tried out everything on us that week. It was wonderful. We just, I think that was some of the best food I've ever had anywhere.
So tell me, what kind of food did you have?
Oh, my God. I have to pull it off my Facebook page. I mean, we had a five-course meal. Let me see if I can pull it up here real quickly. But because I have a photo of it, of the menu. Every night, it was kind of like eating at Millennium every night. Mm. I mean, that's how good this food was. And the Millennium is actually one of my favorite places on Earth, and I'm really sad that they're closing down. But, I had, like, a sushi dish one night. I had this pumpkin soup, which I don't like pumpkin soups, but I loved it. It was just fabulous. And then there was a mushroom dish that was fabulous. You can actually see the menu on my Facebook page that I posted. I don't know. There was too much food to. They even made vegan ice cream out of bananas one night that it's just, my God, it was so good.
Well, that's exciting. So, yeah. This place isn't normally vegetarian, but
it's not.
They're catering.
Right, and they're incorporating it. And I think part of it was because I've been sending so many vegans down there. You know, that, as I said, that's happened a couple times before. There was another time where I used to take groups of people to Best Friends Animal Sanctuary, and we would volunteer at the sanctuary for a couple days, and then we went to Zion National Park for a couple days and stayed at a spa. And there was a hotel there called, it's an Irish name, actually, and I'm blanking out on it. It's Zion. Okay. Well, anyway, they had a they had a restaurant there called Red Dog Cafe. And because I would bring so many vegans down there, they started doing a tofu scramble in the morning, and they put it on as their permanent menu.
Oh, nice.
So, yes, when you travel as a vegan, it does make a difference.
And are there some places you frequent more than others?
I tend to go to Ireland.
Uh-huh.
What
do you get when you're in Ireland?
Oh, my gosh. You know what I love about Ireland? And it's not just the food, it's the people. You know, we usually rent a car and get bed and breakfast properties, and we stay with the locals. And you get so much more out of that. You get all the, you know, the behind-the-scenes kind of things to do and see and hear. You know, the music is great there. The food is better than other parts of Europe, I think.
Really?
It's gotten a lot better in the past couple, you know, maybe the past 10 years.
Not just potatoes.
No, not just potatoes. But you know what? They've had so many problems with hoof and mouth, mad cow, and all, you know, these other things that they have a better understanding of being a vegan or vegetarian than a lot of other countries do. Hmm. You know, they really got hit hard, 10 years ago with all that stuff. So, you know, every year I go back, it just seems like there's more and more vegan options there.
And what kind of vegetables do you get there? Do they grow everything?
Yes, everything is usually typically organic and grown locally.
Wow.
At the very least, grown locally.
Hmm. Oh, I have, you know, I've traveled a lot, but I have not made it to Ireland. I'm going to have to do that.
Oh, I love it there. In fact, I was just with my stepson and his fiance, and they're looking at, they just said to me, we think we want to go to Ireland, and I was elated. I was like, oh my God, I can just tell you right now what we can do, you know.
Have you been to other places that really surprised you in terms of what they offered when you got there that you weren't expecting?
Kenya? Yes! There's a couple. I mean, Paris was another one that actually, well, Paris was a little harder, but Kenya, I went there in 2001, and I do intend to go back there soon, because that's why I got into the travel business, was to go to Africa. That was a childhood dream.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had been to South Africa for my honeymoon back in 1994, and it was hard then. I think it's gotten a lot easier in South Africa, so I thought when I was going to Kenya, I would have the same difficulties that I did in South Africa. And I was actually kind of happy because I thought I would lose some weight. And what happened was, you know, I was with a bunch of travel agents, and we were on what you call a familiarization trip, which means you go to these places and you learn about the country and the hotels. It's a work trip, basically, but mm-hmm. It is, you know, you do have fun at the same time. So I was, like, really kind of nervous that I wouldn't eat anything, so I do what I always do, is I told the tour operator I'm a vegan, I don't eat this and that and the other, and this was in 2001, so while the internet was around, it wasn't quite as easy. So I made sure all that was going to be okay. And then I get there, and at the restaurant, each restaurant, they'd say, oh, you're the vegetarian, and I'd say, yes, and they would leave, and they'd say, no problem. And then I would look over to, like, the right or left of me, and I'd see that there's a vegetarian table. So I would go over to the vegetarian table, and I'd get my dinner, and then they would come over with my special vegetarian dish they made for me. So I had, like, two dinners, two lunches, two breakfasts, whatever, you know, and it was all vegan. The reason is because there's a very large Indian population in Kenya. So it's very easy to be vegetarian and vegan there.
Wow. Well, I'm hungry, and you've got me wanting to go. The weather's getting better here. It's time to go.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, thanks for joining me, and it's all about food, so people can find you at greenearthtravel.com.
Yes, ma'am.
That's great. Okay, well, travel safely wherever you go.
Thank you.
Okay, take care.
All right, bye-bye.
We have a few minutes left, and I just wanted to go over a few things that I wanted to mention to you. So there are some events coming up. And in this month, we've got March 29th is the annual Veggie Pride Parade in Manhattan. You can go to veggieprideparade.org, get more information about it. I will be there. I will be speaking, and Responsible Eating and Living will have a table there, and say hi if you're there. It's a really fun event, and I'm hoping for good weather because last year it was freezing. Now, this next event, you really got to pay attention now because I'm inviting you to my birthday party. It's on April 22nd, Earth Day. It's here in Forest Hills, Queens, in my hood. It's a fundraiser for Responsible Eating and Living. I would love to meet you. I would love to see you there. I would love for you to find out more about Responsible Eating and Living and support what we do. So please just go to the website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, and you can find out more about it. All the information is right there on the homepage. And you know what? If you can't make it, I'm going to be really disappointed that I can't see you. And normally I don't accept birthday presents, but I do accept donations to my nonprofit. So I would really appreciate that. What else can I tell you about? I was just at the Seed Pop-Up Market this weekend, and this is really fun. So the Seed Experience is a plant-based vegan organization, and every month now they're starting to have a seed market where local businesses can sell their wares. And it's a nice thing to help promote these different businesses. It's so hard to get started when you're a small business and have people find out about your products. And all of these products are plant-based, and it's really exciting. And it brought me back to when I used to run what I believe was the largest vegan festival probably in America at the time, and I definitely in New York, which was the Taste of Health. I did it from 2002 to 2006 for 5 years. It was at the Lincoln Center campus. It was beautiful. It was an all-outdoor event. Do you remember it? Were you there? But one of the missions behind that event was to help support local businesses, and this was over 10 years ago, and there just weren't that many in New York. There were more in California, actually, at that time. But now there are so many local businesses popping up, making great things out of food. And not all of it's to eat. Some of it's for those nice-smelling creams and lotions and soap. And like I always say, our skin is our largest organ, and you don't want to be putting anything on your skin that you can't eat. So this is exciting that there's more of that coming about. I also wanted to mention visiting responsibleeatingandliving.com because I've got this new blog, What Vegans Eat. I'm having a lot of fun posting what's going on in the food world here at Responsible Eating and Living headquarters, and you can get to see some great recipes and dishes. I just came up with a new salad dressing. I love it. It's so simple. I'm really into these seed dressings now where you blend up a raw seed with either a vinegar or a citrus and some other flavorings. Try this. Sunflower seeds, water, and balsamic vinegar. Cup of sunflower seeds, cup of water, half quarter cup of balsamic vinegar. Blend it up. It's a tasty, beautiful dressing. And if you're trying to get more dark leafy greens in your life, those bitter, really nutritious greens, this is a great dressing because it's slightly sweet and the balance is phenomenal. Right? Right. So I hope to see you on April 22nd at the Happy Earth Day Review. Go to responsibleeatingandliving.com. If you have any questions, what do? You email me at info@realmeals.org. Okay, thanks for listening, everybody. Remember, have a delicious week. Bye-bye.